There comes a night when the mind stops obeying its old commands. The sentences you once used to keep the world in place no longer hold. What used to be certainty frays like wet paper, and even your strategies for staying afloat, work, performance, explanation, lose their grip. It can look like failure from the outside. It can feel like collapse from the inside. But something deeper is happening. You are entering a heat you did not choose, and you are not being ruined by it. You are being refined. Jung called this pressure toward transformation the work of individuation, the psyche's insistence that a life become whole rather than merely successful. When the old story breaks, the break is not random. Projections recoil, ideals lose their glamour, inherited identities loosen, and what you have exiled returns with its bill. Shadow steps through the doorway. Grief, anger, shame, longing, all the guests you never meant to invite, take their seats at the table and refuse to leave. The ego cannot negotiate a quick settlement. It is outmatched by something vaster, a center of gravity Jung named the self, which does not consult our schedules or our taste for comfort. Dark night is the name many traditions give this phase. Not the melodrama of despair, not a posture meant to impress, but a real night that hides what was once obvious and demands a new kind of seeing. It is not punishment. It is not proof that you have failed at life or faith or discipline. It is the way meaning molts, the way a soul grows too large for its previous container and must risk a larger shape. What hurts is the friction between what is dying and what is waiting to be born. The image that serves me best for this passage is a crucible. In a laboratory or a forge, the crucible is not only about heat, it is about containment. Fire without a vessel scatters and destroys. A vessel without fire merely stores what already is. In the psyche, the crucible is the felt space where intensity can be endured and worked with, an inner temenos, a protected room where images speak, feelings unfold, and truth is allowed to outlast panic. When the heat rises, the task is not to prove your toughness. The task is to build and inhabit the vessel that can hold the heat long enough for it to change you. This change rarely arrives as revelation on command. It moves through the body, through dreams, through the small negotiations of a day. Sleep thins, appetite wanders, the old pleasures turn tasteless, the old irritations become unignorable. You may find yourself telling the truth by accident, startling even yourself with the clarity of a sudden no or a surprising yes. You may feel abandoned by the very ideas that once rescued you. If you are a person of faith, the heavens can seem mute. If you are a person of reason, logic can feel like a ladder against the wrong wall. Either way, the intellect must learn humility, and the heart must learn endurance. There is no shortcut through this part, yet there is companionship. Others have crossed their own nights and left markers along the path. Jung's language of alchemy, the blackening, the whitening, the reddening, offers one such map. It is not a superstition, it is a psychology of transformation disguised in metals and fire. First the dissolution, then the washing and clarification, then the integration and embodied return. The order is not always tidy, and no two passages are identical, but the grammar of change repeats across lives like a melody with infinite variations. Knowing this does not eliminate the pain, but it can loosen the panic around the pain. You are not uniquely cursed. You are being asked to become specific. A warning belongs here, and I offer it with care. Suffering is not automatically sacred. Sometimes it is a signal that something is wrong in a way that demands immediate help, medical, psychological, practical. We will not romanticize breakdown. We will not confuse dangerous symptoms with spiritual depth. The work ahead will include clear guidance on when to seek professional support and how to distinguish an existential descent from an illness that requires treatment. Courage includes knowing when to call for help. If you stay with this process, the night will not end because you crushed it into submission, but because something in you consented to be changed. The heat separates dross from essence. The pressure reveals what can carry weight. The container, the practices, the relationships, the small rituals that mark time, teaches your nervous system that intensity can be survived and shaped. Over time, a different kind of strength appears, less performative and more quiet, a capacity to belong to your own life without negotiating away its truth. This essay is an invitation into that work. We will name what Dark Knight means in a Jungian frame, why the metaphor of a mental crucible matters, how descent tends to unfold, and what helps. We will speak of dreams and images, of the body and its wisdom, of analysis and friendship and simple rituals that keep a flame alive. We will walk the alchemical arc without fetishizing it, and we will address the common ways the journey tilts into inflation, bypass, or nihilism. Above all, we will try to keep faith with reality, its beauty and its terror, because reality is the only fire worth trusting. If you are here, you may already be in the furnace. You do not need grand promises from me. You need a room that does not lie to you, a language that can bear weight, and a path that does not ask you to betray what you know. This is that room. This is that language. This is a path, not the only one, but one that has served many. You are not broken. You are being smelted. Let us begin. What we mean by Dark Knight, Jung's frame. When people hear Dark Knight of the Soul, many think of Saint John of the Cross and the purgative path of the mystic. That lineage matters, but our focus here is psychological rather than doctrinal. In Jung's language, the Dark Knight is not a test from an external judge. It is a reorganization initiated by the psyche itself. The ego, which has been driving with a familiar map, discovers that the terrain has changed. What once worked, the beliefs, roles, and reflexes that secured belonging or achievement, loses efficacy. The result is not merely sadness, it is disorientation with purpose. Jung's frame centers on individuation, the lifelong movement toward wholeness in which a person becomes more than their social mask and conscious preferences. The Dark Knight marks a phase in that movement when the unconscious presses unmistakably into awareness and demands a renegotiation of authority. The ego has been living as if it were the center. Now it meets the self, the deeper organizing principle of the psyche that includes but exceeds the conscious personality. This encounter rarely feels like a gentle meeting. It feels like pressure. It feels like a summons that interrupts your scheduled life. A key feature of this phase is the withdrawal of projections. For years, we cast unlived qualities onto partners, leaders, enemies, gods, and ideals, arranging the world to carry what we could not admit in ourselves. During the Dark Knight, that scaffolding buckles. The hero on whom you hung your hope falters. The villain you blamed reveals a human face. The god you outsourced your courage to falls silent enough that you must locate a voice within. It can feel like betrayal. It is, more precisely, a recall of energy, the psyche repossessing what belongs to you so it can be integrated rather than worshipped or attacked at a distance. Because the personality has been invested in its previous arrangement, this recall is experienced as loss, loss of certainty, loss of taste for the old performances, loss of identity that once felt earned. Today's culture often interprets this as failure or burnout, a signal to optimize routines or swap careers. But the Jungian view invites a deeper reading. The structure that carried you has reached the edge of its usefulness. The night is not the end of meaning. It is the end of a smaller meaning that cannot bear the weight of your life as it actually is. Jung borrowed the language of alchemy to describe what happens next because the psyche speaks in images, not manuals. In alchemy, matter is placed in a sealed vessel and subjected to heat so that hidden essences can be separated, purified, and recombined. The Dark Knight corresponds to the first stage, the blackening, when forms decay and certainty rots. This is not decay for decay's sake. It is decomposition in service of recomposition. The vessel is your capacity to contain experience without collapsing into panic or cementing into denial. The fire is the intensity of reality finally admitted. To call this a mental crucible is to emphasize that we are dealing with a transformation that includes thought, but is not reducible to thought. Ideas are involved, yes, especially the ideas you have used to justify avoidance. Yet the work is lived in images, in dreams, in bodily sensations, in the sudden flood of memory, in the awkward honesty of conversations that no longer allow your old script. A philosophy that cannot survive this furnace was only a costume. A faith that cannot breathe here was only a performance. The psyche is asking for something truer than performance. None of this implies that suffering is inherently noble or that every confusion is a sacred event. The Dark Knight in Jung's sense has a signature. It constellates meaning even as it dissolves certainties and it pushes toward integration rather than fragmentation. There is a directionality to it. A quiet teleology felt as the insistence that what has been split must be brought back into relationship. That is why dreams intensify, why symbols cluster, why chance encounters feel charged. The system is reorganizing around a larger center. So when we say dark night in this essay, we do not mean an aesthetic for brooding or a license to wallow. We mean a passage in the individuation process where the ego's map fails because the territory has become more complex and more honest, and where the self exerts a corrective gravity. The task is not to outthink the night or to bully it into ending. The task is to recognize what it is and consent to the work it requires. Only then can the heat do what heat does best, separate what burns away from what remains. Why call it a mental crucible? A crucible is not only the fire, it is the vessel that makes fire useful. Without containment, heat merely scorches and disperses. Within a sound vessel, the same heat separates, purifies, and recombines. When I call the dark night a mental crucible, I am naming that double structure, intensity plus holding. The psyche turns up the temperature. Memories that would not surface arrive unbidden. Contradictions tighten. Meanings clash, and at the same time demands a shape capable of bearing that temperature without cracking. The crucible is the form that keeps you from mistaking combustion for transformation. Containment is not the same as suppression. Suppression is a lid slammed down on a boiling pot, a refusal to know. Containment is a deliberate architecture of attention and care that allows difficult material to appear without letting it flood or shatter you. In practice, it feels like a room inside you that stays intact even while storms pass through. A conversation that would have scattered you last year can now be endured and explored. A dream that would have been dismissed as nonsense becomes a text you can sit with until its images speak. You are not less feeling. You are more capacious. Heat is transmuted into information. Jung borrowed alchemical images because they dramatize this partnership between fire and form. The ancient texts spoke of the vas hermeticum, the sealed vessel in which metals could be cooked without their essence evaporating. Psychologically, the vessel is made of time, attention, and ritual reliability. You set a regular hour to meet your inner life, and you keep the appointment even when you would rather escape. You establish boundaries that reduce noise, not because you are delicate, but because static steals the subtle signals you need to hear. You speak plainly with one trusted person who does not panic when you tell the truth. In each case, you are strengthening the walls of the vessel so the work can proceed. The crucible metaphor also corrects a cultural mistake. We imagine change as either a grind, white-knuckled willpower, or a lightning strike, sudden revelation that spares us the work. The crucible honors a slower alchemy. The ego does not engineer the self into existence. It collaborates by enduring the fire and tending the form. That collaboration is humbling. You cannot schedule insight, but you can prepare a chair for it. You cannot decide which memory returns, but you can decide not to run when it does. You cannot force symbols to yield meaning, but you can keep them near until meaning ripens. There is a danger on both sides of the process. Too much heat without enough vessel becomes agitation, mania, fragmentation. The mind races. The body jolts. Interpretations proliferate without landing. Too much vessel without enough heat becomes sterility. Tight routines masquerading as growth. Spiritual practices that anesthetize rather than awaken. The balance shifts from week to week. Sometimes the courageous act is to open the window and let more air in. Sometimes the courageous act is to close the door and stay put. The measure is simple and demanding. Does this increase your capacity to remain present to what is true? Calling this a mental crucible can sound severe, but the tone of the work is gentler than the metaphor suggests. The container is built with small fidelities rather than heroics. You eat real food. You sleep as well as you can. You walk without headphones until the world re-enters your senses. You write even when you have nothing eloquent to say. You sit with a dream's strange image long enough that its strangeness becomes familiar. These are not decorations around the real work. They are the walls that keep the fire from spilling. In their simplicity, they teach the nervous system that intensity can be held and shaped, not only endured. Above all, the crucible respects mystery without surrendering agency. You cannot master the process, but you are not passive cargo. You are the artisan of the vessel in which the unknown does its work. You adjust the heat by the choices you make about exposure and rest. You strengthen the walls by the honesty you practice and the distractions you relinquish. You decide again and again not to abandon yourself when the dross rises and the room smells of burning. In time, that fidelity changes the quality of the fire. It becomes less like punishment and more like a steady flame you can trust. Anatomy of the descent. Every descent announces itself in a private dialect, but the grammar is strangely consistent. It begins with erosion. Meanings that once held like bedrock start to crumble under your feet. You finish the same tasks and feel none of the old reward. You repeat the same beliefs and hear an echo rather than conviction. Friends and routines still fit your calendar, yet they do not fit your life. The first response is usually adjustment. Optimize. Substitute. Upgrade. But the deeper current does not yield to optimization. It asks you to notice that the scaffolding no longer touches the building. Sooner or later, the uninvited arrives. What you have exiled from consciousness returns, not as an abstraction, but as mood and impulse. Anger that had been moralized away presents its raw claim. Grief, previously intellectualized, becomes heavy in the chest at inconvenient hours. Envy confesses itself in the mind's quiet corners. These are not proof of failure. They are proof that the shadow, the unowned, disallowed, and underlived aspects of the personality has been granted a hearing. It is frightening precisely because it is intimate. The figures you drove into the wilderness come back to your door speaking your own voice. Dreams intensify and take on a texture your daytime mind does not control. You may find yourself walking through basements, crossing dark water, returning to childhood homes that rearrange themselves as you explore. Strange visitors appear and demand attention, guides, seducers, critics, children, each carrying a fragment of meaning that will not survive literal interpretation. The rational mind will be tempted to dismiss these scenes as noise. The wiser response is to treat them as night letters from a part of you that refuses email. Symbolic life thickens when surface certainty thins. The psyche compensates for what daylight has lost. As the descent deepens, ordinary strategies yield diminishing returns. Distraction works briefly and then backfires as the nervous system grows tired of being tricked. Overwork masks anxiety until the body begins to insist on rest. Hypervigilant control of diet, of schedule, of other people's perceptions, exhausts itself. The habits that kept you together are revealed as ways you kept yourself away. This can feel like weakness. In truth, it is a release of tactics that no longer serve the complexity of the life you are actually living. The personality runs out of costumes because the play has changed. Relationships shift in this light. People who rely on your old mask become uneasy when it slips. Conversations that used to orbit shared complaints or shared ambitions falter because you cannot supply the required performance. Some connections cool without drama. Others intensify around a new honesty that is both costly and relieving. Solitude expands, sometimes by choice, sometimes by circumstance. The danger here is isolation that curdles into despair. The opportunity is a quieter field in which you can hear your own interior more clearly, provided you keep one or two lifelines to the human world. The body keeps the most accurate clock of all. Sleep patterns fray and then reset to a different rhythm. Appetite meanders before it refines a simpler preference for what actually nourishes. The chest tightens at certain memories and softens at the thought of certain places. A walk taken without headphones becomes unexpectedly medicinal. These somatic notes are not trivia, they are barometers. The descent is not a purely mental event. It is a full system recalibration in which the organism renegotiates what it takes in and what it releases. Inflation and collapse often alternate like weather fronts. One day brings a realization so vivid it feels like revelation. The next day brings an emptiness so total it feels like futility. Do not panic at this oscillation. The psyche is testing new configurations, swinging wide before it settles nearer a true center. Grandiosity is a risk here, identifying with the insight as if you were now above ordinary limits, and so is nihilism, mistaking the ash of burned illusions for the whole truth. Both are understandable. Both are forms of impatience. The work is to hold the swing without freezing it at either extreme. Time itself changes character. The future you used to manage recedes, and the past you used to curate becomes more honest. Memories unspool without your usual editing, not to indict you, but to include you more fully. You may notice that the story you have told about yourself cannot carry certain scenes without distortion. This is painful and liberating at once. A truer narrative begins to assemble itself, not yet polished, but sturdier because it can bear contradiction. The descent dismantles the museum of you so that a living house can be built. If we were to draw this passage, it would not be a clean staircase, but a spiral. You circle the same themes from different heights, seeing a little more each time, enduring a little better each round. There is progress, but it is not linear, and it cannot be measured by external milestones. The most trustworthy sign that you are moving is not constant insight, but increasing capacity. To feel without drowning, to pause before reacting, to name what is happening without theatrics. The night is doing its work. The crucible is holding. Something in you that has always been true is becoming available to the life you actually live. Symptoms versus signals, when it's a spiritual emergency and when it's clinical. Two obligations govern this passage: protect life and dignity and allow transformation. The first has priority. No image, insight, or hunger for meaning is worth your safety. Once safety is secured, the deeper work can proceed. A Jungian dark night belongs to the second obligation. It is the psyche's pressure toward wholeness, yet it often travels close to territory that requires medical or psychological care. Wisdom is the art of telling which is which, and of refusing the false choice between them. The dark night carries sorrow, confusion, and fatigue, but it usually preserves a faint vector toward meaning. Even in grief, something in you knows the pain is about truth rather than mere collapse. Dreams thicken and feel purposeful. Symbols cluster around themes that matter to your life rather than scattering into static. Energy comes in pulses. Difficult mornings give way to lucid hours. Heavy days are interrupted by moments of precise honesty. Major depressive disorder tends to feel different. Mood flattens into a gray that coats everything. Interest and pleasure vanish even when you try to stir them. Thought slows or grows cruel. Sleep and appetite skew in ways you cannot influence, and the day holds no islands of clarity. These are not hard boundaries. Conditions overlap. People are unique, but the phenomenology diverges. A dark night hurts in the direction of meaning. Clinical depression hurts in a way that drains meaning away. When danger signs appear, treat them as non-negotiable. Persistent thoughts of suicide or rehearsing a plan, an inability to sleep for days without relief, voices or visions that command action, beliefs that detach from all reality testing, a sudden escalation in substance use, violent swings in mood or behavior that frighten you or those around you. The postpartum period combined with despair or intrusive harm thoughts, abrupt cessation of prescribed medication, self-neglect that puts health at risk. Any of these mean you seek help now. Call a clinician, speak to your GP, go to urgent care, tell the person who will actually come to your door. Courage is not stoicism. Courage is securing the ground on which any transformation can take place. Spiritual emergency is the phrase some clinicians use for passages where symbolic, archetypal material floods consciousness so quickly that it destabilizes ordinary functioning. The task then is both containment and care. Slow the influx, strengthen the vessel, and bring in a steady outside frame. Medication, if prescribed, is not an admission of failure. It is a way to lower the temperature so the work can be done without cracking the vessel. Therapy is not a detour from the path. It is a room in which the path can unfold without harming you or others. You do not choose between analysis and medicine, between ritual and psychiatry, between prayer and sleep. You choose what keeps you safe and makes you more truthful. A common confusion in this territory is between numinous energy and mania. The first arrives as vitality braided with humility. You feel more alive and also more responsible. The second often carries a decreased need for sleep, racing thought that outpaces meaning, impulsive risk-taking, grand certainty about special missions, and irritability when contradicted. Another confusion lives between the imaginal and the psychotic. In active imagination and dream work, images are treated as if they are persons with whom you can converse. They are granted dignity without being mistaken for literal facts. Psychosis tends to erode that as-if quality. The image hardens into unarguable reality, and the capacity to negotiate symbols as symbols disappears. Retaining the ability to wonder, to doubt, to reality test with a trusted other is a good sign that you are in symbolic terrain rather than in a medical crisis. There are practical ways to bias the process toward health while you discern what you are facing. Tell one person the unvarnished truth about how you are and keep them in the loop daily. See a clinician for a sober assessment. Sometimes blood work and a clear sleep plan do more for the soul than another night of heroic thinking. Reduce stimulants and alcohol so your nervous system can read its own signals. Avoid sudden experiments with psychedelics or drastic fasting during acute destabilization. Amplification is not what a flooded system needs. Keep one or two small routines, regular meals, a consistent bedtime, a brief walk without headphones, not as self-improvement theater, but as anchors that reassure the body it is not being abandoned. The point is not to diagnose yourself from an essay. The point is to honor both realities at once. The psyche has its seasons of night, and the body brain has its illnesses. Refusing treatment out of spiritual pride is as dangerous as dismissing a meaningful dissent as just brain chemistry. Hold the both and. Get the help that protects your life. Then, from that cleared and steadied ground, you can return to the work that called you here in the first place. The work inside the crucible. The first task is to make a room strong enough to hold what arrives. That room is not an abstraction. It is a set of hours you protect from noise, a desk cleared of the props that invite distraction, a notebook that becomes a steady interlocutor, a walking rote you learn by heart, a kettle that knows when to boil. The psyche trusts reliability. When you keep simple appointments with yourself, images begin to risk appearing. You are teaching the nervous system that there is an adult in the house who will not flee when the temperature rises. In that steadiness, fire becomes information. Active imagination is one of the most direct ways to collaborate with the descent. Rather than treating difficult feelings as problems to be solved, you allow them to present as figures and scenes. You close your eyes or lower them to the page and invite the mood to take shape. Perhaps a critic appears, or a child you forgot, or an animal that will not be tamed. You speak to it as if it were real, because psychologically it is. You ask what it wants, what it fears, what it is guarding. You answer honestly from your side. You do not force a moral. You let the dialogue run until it reaches a natural pause, and then you write what occurred without editing. Over time, these encounters loosen the knots the conscious mind could not untie. What was previously a nameless heaviness becomes a relationship that can change. Dream work belongs beside this practice, like night beside day. Dreams are the psyche's letters written in images, and their grammar is symbol rather than fact. Recording them on waking, dates, settings, colors, feelings, gives them a continuity that your memory cannot. The point is not to decode them into tidy messages, but to sit with their atmospheres until the patterns show themselves. A recurring staircase may reveal the places you climb without purpose. A flooded room may show grief looking for a door. When you revisit these images across weeks, amplifying them with myths or stories that carry similar motifs, the meaning densifies. It is less that you figure out the dream and more that you make a life in which its truth can breathe. Writing is the alembic where these materials condense. Not performance writing, not essays for an audience, but the plain ledger in which you describe exactly what happened inside and outside you today. Date every entry. Note the body as carefully as the mind. Where did the chest tighten? When did the jaw loosen? What old memory paired itself to what new irritation? Let the sentences be ugly if that is what honesty requires. The page is not a court, it is a vessel. Over time, the record becomes a map of your descent, and you can see what your moods cannot. What triggers overwhelm? What restores proportion? What images recur and which finally dissolve once they have been witnessed. Because this is a whole body process, you will need anchors that are not made of thought. Breath is an instrument, not a concept. Slow exhalations lengthen the present moment and tell the autonomic system that it is not under immediate threat. Walking without headphones restores the world's contours and returns you to shared reality when the interior becomes too loud. Cooking simple food and eating at a table remind the animal that it has a caretaker. Sleep hygiene, dimming lights, cooling the room, turning away from the blue-lit scroll, does not make you virtuous. It makes you more available to your own life. The measure is always the same. Does the practice increase your capacity to remain present to what is true? No one does this alone, and alone with dignity is not the same as isolation. One wise friend can become a bridge back to the human world when speech threatens to fail. The right therapist or analyst provides a room where truth can land without shattering the furniture. The value here is not advice, though advice has its hour, but containment and reality testing. You say the thing you were certain would exile you, and you discover you are not exiled. You describe the dream you thought was ridiculous, and it is taken seriously enough to unfold. In that shared attention, the images complete a portion of their journey, and the pressure lowers enough that you can sleep. Ritual is the skeleton that keeps the day from collapsing into formlessness. It does not have to be ornate. Lighting a candle at the start of your writing hour, washing your face before you enter a difficult conversation with an inner figure, touching a stone you keep on the desk when panic rises, these gestures mark thresholds the body understands. They signal that you are entering and leaving the work on purpose. Many lives unravel here not because the fire is too hot, but because time becomes a smear. If you can, let morning be for tending the inside and afternoon for returning to the world. If your life allows no such division, choose a smaller frame you can actually keep and defend it without apology. It helps to reduce the influx of counterfeit fire. News fed in frantic doses does not make you responsible. It makes you inflamed. Infinite scroll does not inform. It agitates. During the descent, guard your inputs as if you were recovering from an illness, because you are. Curate what you let through the walls, not as purity theater, but as a way to let subtle signals be heard. Art belongs here as a trustworthy flame, music that widens the chest, poems that keep the language honest, paintings that teach you how to see again. Beauty recalibrates the nervous system without demanding that you pretend everything is fine. Expect boredom and respect it. Boredom is not failure. It is the detox of a mind habituated to constant stimulation. When the room feels empty and the page refuses you, do not sprint to the nearest distraction. Sit a little longer. Let the nothing disclose what it actually is, the space in which a different kind of attention can grow. Many of the psyche's images are shy. They appear when they are not being chased. The discipline is gentle persistence rather than heroic conquest. You will be tempted to measure progress by dramatic breakthroughs. Resist that metric. The real sign the work is proceeding is quieter. You find yourself telling the truth earlier in a conversation and needing fewer words to do it. You notice the first flicker of an old defense and choose not to run it to its endpoint. You wake from a difficult dream and feel gratitude rather than panic, because at least now you know what you are carrying. These are not headlines. They are structural changes. The crucible is doing what a good vessel does, holding steady while the contents transform. All of this takes longer than you want and less time than you fear. The calendar will not certify your readiness, and the psyche will not grant you a diploma. What you will have instead is a life that fits more cleanly, a relationship to your own images that is less adversarial, and a capacity for reality that does not collapse when the script fails. The work inside the crucible is ordinary in its means and extraordinary in its effects. It makes you simpler and more specific. It returns you to yourself in a way that allows you to belong to others without pretending. That is not a small gift. It is the beginning of a different kind of freedom. The alchemical arc. Alchemy gives us a grammar for change sturdy enough to carry the psyche's ambiguities. It is not chemistry and it is not superstition. It is a symbolic language for what happens when a life is placed under heat within a worthy vessel. The arc names recurring moods of transformation rather than steps on a calendar. It tells us that dissolution is not an error, that clarification is possible, and that integration is a matter of blood and breath rather than slogans. The night begins in negredo, the blackening. Structures collapse, meanings rot, and what once felt solid turns to sludge. This is the smell of putrefaction in the soul, and it is more honest than the perfumes we use to wear. The mind searches for a switch to flip and finds none. The work here is radical allowance, to let decay do its dissolving without interpreting it as verdict. You are not being punished. Compounds are being taken apart so they can be recombined on truer terms. If you stay, panic loosens into grief, and grief into a quiet ferocity that refuses both denial and melodrama. Out of that darkness, small clearings appear. Albedo, the whitening, is not euphoria. It is a rinsing. The day grows cleaner around the edges. You begin to tell the truth without theatrics. The same memory that once flooded you now sits across the table and can be named. Differentiation returns. This is mine, that is yours. This belongs to the past, that belongs to the present. You feel less compelled to defend the mask and more willing to let the face beneath be seen. Washing is a better metaphor than victory. What is clarified is not your superiority, but your sight. Between these phases, there is no single door. Light pools inside the dark long before dawn, and the sky remembers night well into morning. The psyche moves in spirals, not ladders. It revisits old ground with a slightly altered center of gravity. Expect backslides and regard them as further rounds in the same kiln, rather than proofs that the work has failed. The vessel holds through these oscillations, so that change can deepen rather than scatter. In many old texts, citronitis, the yellowing, is the forgotten dawn between whitening and reddening. Psychologically, it matters. Here a first warmth returns. Curiosity revives without turning manic. Energy gathers in the limbs, not just the head. You make one clean promise to yourself and keep it for a week. You discover you can refuse a familiar seduction without self-hatred. The world looks less like a problem to be solved and more like a place that could be inhabited again. This is not the sun at noon. It is the hour when birds begin before we do. Rubedo, the reddening, is integration with pulse. Blood re-enters the image. Insight takes a body. You feel the seam between reflection and action knit itself into a cleaner line, and your choices stop advertising themselves as special. Purpose descends from rhetoric into craft. Love becomes less about rescue and more about presence. You return to work, to partnership, to the street, not as a conqueror of darkness, but as someone who can carry light without making a spectacle of it. Red is the color of embodiment and responsibility. It marks the moment when what you learned in the crucible begins to serve lives other than your own. Threaded through the whole arc is what Jung called the transcendent function, the psyche's way of holding opposites long enough that a third living term can emerge. It is not compromise. It is not averaging. It is the slow birth of forms that can honor both poles without mutilating either. Strength that does not banish tenderness, solitude that does not betray belonging, authority that does not eclipse humility. The medium of this birth is symbol, a dream image, a line of poetry, a tune you hum for days. These bridge what argument could not. They carry more than they explain, and in carrying, change you. You will know the arc is working not because you glow, but because your language gets simpler. Your no arrives earlier and needs fewer words. Your yes lands in the body rather than in performance. Projection loses its glamour. The person you were about to cast as hero or villain returns to human size. Desire grows more honest and less theatrical. A reliable test lives in the ordinary. Can the insight survive dishes, deadlines, and disagreement without inflating you or collapsing you? If it can, the reddening has begun. None of this is linear or guaranteed. The same life may pass through several blackenings and many small dawns. The crucible does not prevent recurrence. It prevents amnesia. With each round, you remember more quickly what is happening and waste less time on panic or pretense. You also grow less interested in trophies. The goal is not to collect stages, but to become a person whose presence bears weight. This map is a kindness because it tells the truth about tempo. You cannot yank yourself from black to red by force of will, and you do not need to. Your task is to tend the vessel and honor the fire, containment and heat, so that the colors can come in their season. Before we go further, it is worth naming how the journey most often derails, not to shame the traveler, but to protect the work. Common failure modes. Every genuine passage has counterfeit versions that look convincing from a distance. The psyche is not out to trick you, But pressure reveals weak spots, and the ego is ingenious at improvising detours that feel like progress. Naming these failure modes is not an invitation to paranoia. It is a way to protect hard-won movement from being siphoned into spectacle or despair. Inflation is the first and most seductive. After a real insight, the center of gravity can swing from humility to grandiosity without passing through balance. You mistake contact with the self for a promotion. Ordinary limits feel beneath you. Ordinary people feel slow. The mind begins issuing announcements, missions, destinies, special exemptions from consequences, and irritation greets any friction with reality. The antidote is not self-loathing, it is specificity. Keep appointments, pay bills, apologize when you miss the mark. Let work and relationship be the proving ground. What belongs to truth will survive chores, what belongs to fantasy will demand an audience. Spiritual bypassing is inflation's polished cousin. Instead of feeling grief, you narrate transcendence. Instead of anger, you offer cosmic perspective. Pain is lacquered with meaning so quickly that it cannot breathe. Bypassers sound wise and leave rooms colder. The corrective is simple and difficult. Let feelings complete their animal cycle in the body before recruiting them into philosophy. If the idea arrives before the tears, wait. If the forgiveness arrives before the boundary, wait. Reality does not need a shiny story from you. It needs your honest presence. Nihilism is the backlash when idols burn. Discovering that a cherished belief was a mask, the mind concludes that all beliefs are masks. Seeing through one illusion, it mistakes ash for truth. Cynicism impersonates intelligence here because it looks like immunity to being fooled. In fact, it is a refusal to be moved. The way through is discrimination rather than collapse. Some structures were lies. Some were scaffolds that served their season. Some are bones you will still need. Practice keeping what is alive without pretending the dead still breathe. Literalism is a quieter derailment that often hides inside sincere practice. A dream presents a death and you panic about someone's health. A symbol of union appears and you propose to the nearest person. An archetypal pattern flickers and you retrofit your biography to match it. The imaginal asks to be honored as if, serious without being mistaken for fact. When images harden into non-negotiable claims about the outer world, flexibility dies and the psyche retaliates with either rebellion or collapse. Write the dream down. Live with it. Let it inflect your attention rather than dictate your behavior. Addiction to intensity masquerades as devotion to depth. After months of dulling yourself with distraction, the furnace feels alive, and a part of you begins to chase heat for its own sake. You pick fights to feel honest, court risk to feel free, escalate practices to feel close to the edge. This is the nervous system trying to self-medicate with drama. The corrective is to privilege steadiness over spectacle. Choose practices that restore tone rather than spike it. Let relationships become kinder before they become more fascinating. Depth is not measured in decibels. There is also the failure of secrecy and the failure of exhibition. In the first, you wall off the work from anyone who could reality test it. Privacy becomes a cover for distortion. In the second, you convert the descent into content, reporting every tremor to harvest approval. Both avoid intimacy. The cure is one or two true witnesses, no audience, no bunker, who can hold your story without glamorizing or pathologizing it. Tell them the thing you do not want to say. Let their ordinary questions tether you to earth. Another common derailment is turning the process into identity. The one who is always in the work becomes a role you perform to avoid re-entering life. Suffering acquires prestige. You are drawn to communities where collapse functions as currency, and any return to simplicity is treated as betrayal. The test here is usefulness. If your insights make you less available to ordinary kindness, less reliable in your commitments, less capable of joy, you are not becoming profound, you are becoming self-involved. Let service interrupt you. Let friendship claim an evening you plan to spend staring at your own weather. Guru shopping and theory hopping can look like curiosity, but often signal refusal. When the next framework always promises the key the last one failed to deliver, you are protecting yourself from the discipline of a single room. No system is everything. Choose a container with integrity. Analysis, a sound therapeutic modality, a spiritual tradition with teeth, and give it time to work on you. If you must change vessels, do so soberly and for reasons you can state without sneer or romance. Finally, there is the quiet sabotage of premature return. The pressure lowers, mornings open, and you sprint to seal the gains with big declarations and irreversible choices. New jobs, new loves, new vows, anything to narrate the night is conquered. But integration is slower than revelation. Let the change show itself in small repetitions before you engrave it in public stone. Ask not whether you feel different today, but whether you choose differently on a dull Wednesday. If the crucible has done its work, the proof will be plain. Less drama to tell the truth, less costume to be kind, less negotiation to say no. These derailments do not disqualify you. They are the places where old habits try to regain jurisdiction. See them early, and they become information. Ignore them, and they become a season. Either way, the way back is the same as the way through. Rebuild the vessel, lower the heat, tell the truth to someone who can hold it, and return to the ordinary practices that made transformation possible in the first place. Navigation aids, a simple protocol. The descent respects rhythm more than heroics. Treat each day as a small vessel you can actually carry. On waking, reach first for the life that is yours, not the world's noise. Write a few plain lines about the night, what you dreamed, what you felt before the phone taught you what to feel, and mark the date. Breathe until your body believes you, longer on the exhale than the inhale, and let the room come into focus without commentary. Before work claims you, do one embodied act that asks nothing from language. Walk the same loop, stretch the same sequence, make the same simple breakfast, and eat it seated. These are not chores. They are how you tell the nervous system it will not be abandoned. Through the day, practice one boundary you can keep. No screens in bed, no emails after a set hour, no caffeine after noon, no apologies for a necessary no. In the evening, return to the page and write what actually happened inside you and around you, including the parts that refuse elegance. End by choosing one promise for tomorrow small enough to honor. Keep the day modest. Keep it honest. Repetition is mercy. Once a week, step back far enough to see the pattern your moods cannot. Reread your entries without judgment, just attention. What images keep knocking? When does energy return, and what quietly steals it? Where did you tell the truth sooner, and what did that change? Share one clean piece of your week with a trusted other and let them reality test your conclusions. If life allows, spend half a day somewhere that refuses your performance. By water if you can, among trees if you can't, on a long city walk if you must, until your attention widens and your breath follows. Prepare a few meals that future you will be grateful for when the next hard night arrives. Put your supports in place when you feel steady so they are there when you do not. Have a plan for the hour when everything tilts. Write it down now, while you are lucid, and keep it where your hands will reach. When overwhelm surges, lower the temperature rather than arguing with the weather. Put both feet on the ground. Name 5 things you can see, 4 you can touch, 3 you can hear, 2 you can smell, 1 you can taste. Run cold water over your wrists or splash your face to interrupt the spiral. Breathe in 4, hold 4, out 4, hold 4 until the room returns. Eat something with protein and salt. Text the person you chose in advance and tell them you are using the plan. If the thoughts turn dangerous or your sleep has vanished for nights in a row, do not negotiate with yourself. Call the clinician, go to urgent care, involve the adult who can cross a threshold, and meet you where you are. Courage begins with preserving the life that wants to be transformed. Guard your inputs as you would guard a wound. News in constant doses is a stimulant, not a sacrament. Entertainment that leaves you more agitated than you began is a counterfeit flame. Make a gentler trade, a poem you carry for a week, music that widens your chest, a novel that returns you to human scale. Let art tune your nervous system towards steadiness rather than spectacle. Keep company with one book you read slowly rather than 5 you skim to avoid yourself. Ask of every intake the same question you ask of practices. Does this make me more available to what is true? Leave breadcrumbs for your future self. Keep a short index at the back of your notebook where recurring images, phrases, and dreams are recorded with dates. When a symbol returns, you won't be starting from 0. You will be continuing a conversation. Note the days when your no arrived early and cleanly, the mornings when a familiar panic never started, the evening you felt affection for the person you are becoming. These are proof of movement that adrenaline never notices. They make patience possible. Finally, measure your progress in ordinary terms. Choose one useful task each day that benefits a world beyond your weather and complete it without theater. Return a call, fix the hinge, send the document on time, make soup for someone tired. Let responsibility and kindness be the ground on which transformation proves itself. If the work is real, it will make you simpler, not special, more faithful, not louder. The protocol is not a ladder to climb, but a way to keep the fire modest and the vessel sound so the deeper change can proceed in its own season. Integration and return. There comes a point when the fire no longer feels like a siege. The room is still warm, but it is a warmth you can live in. Insight stops arriving as headlines and begins to settle into muscle memory. The question shifts from what is happening to me to how do I live what I now know? Integration is not a finale. It is the long apprenticeship of giving form to truth in ordinary time. Return is what that apprenticeship looks like in the world. Work resumed without pretense, love practiced without rescue, boundaries kept without theatrics. The first movement of integration is a recall of projection. The energy you once scattered onto idols and enemies begins to come home. You notice the faces you turned into screens and let them recover their contours. The mentor you elevated into a savior becomes a human being with limits you can respect without worship. The adversary you used as a mirror for your disowned anger shrinks to a size you can disagree with without needing to be defined by. This is not a loss of passion. It is the end of enchantment. What returns with that energy is capacity, fierceness that does not require an opponent, devotion that does not require a pedestal. A second movement is the quiet rewrite of your personal myth. The story that once cast you as the tireless fixer, or the brilliant disappointment, or the necessary martyr, no longer fits the scenes of your life. You begin to tell what happened without flattering yourself or condemning yourself, and the narrative breathes. Responsibility becomes specific rather than totalizing. You acknowledge the part you played and also the forces you could not control. Out of that accuracy, a different plot takes shape, less operatic, more durable. It is not the story of escaping the world, but of belonging to it with a cleaner center of gravity. Signs of consolidation appear where you least expect them. You say no earlier, and it lands like a door closing softly rather than like a slammed defense. You say yes to work that suits your contours even when no one applauds. You make amends without converting the apology into a performance. You stop rehearsing conversations in which you finally win. Humor returns in its generous register. Sleep stabilizes enough that the day has edges again. These are not small things. They are the infrastructure of a self that can carry weight. In relationships, return takes the form of simpler promises. Instead of grand declarations about forever or the end of all conflict, you start keeping dates and keeping quiet when silence is kinder. You choose candor over cleverness, and you let other people have their weather without interpreting it as a referendum on you. Intimacy changes temperature. It becomes less about fusion and more about contact. Two distinct lives meeting without disguises. When conflict comes, and it will, you notice earlier the old reflexes gathering at the door, and you ask them to wait while you speak plainly. Work changes not only in content but in posture. You stop choosing tasks that let you dramatize your virtue and start choosing tasks that let you be useful. The metric shifts from excitement to fit. You look for places where your attention, now trained by the crucible, can make something sturdier. Clearer language, cleaner processes, more honest decisions. You allow patience to have a say in your timing. If ambition remains, and why shouldn't it, you treat it as a tool rather than an identity, and you submit it to the same question you ask of every practice. Does this make me more available to what is true? Spiritual life, for those who have one, becomes less theatrical and more embodied. Prayers grow shorter and less certain, and in their brevity they feel truer. Study turns from argument into nourishment. Ritual returns to its rightful size as a way of marking thresholds rather than manipulating outcomes. You are less interested in experiences that prove anything and more interested in practices that keep you honest. If you once fled to heights to avoid the valley, You discover that altitude is no longer your goal. Accuracy is. Integration also requires a reckoning with power. Contact with the deeper center can produce confidence that, if untempered, becomes domination in subtler clothing. The corrective is service without spectacle. Where you have influence, you use it to make room safer for truth rather than safer for your image. Where you have authority, you practice decisions that do not mortgage the future for the thrill of being decisive. You let others be central to their own lives and refuse to conscript them into demonstrating your transformation. None of this means the night has vanished. The psyche moves in seasons. New blackenings will come. The difference after an integration is not immunity, but memory. You recognize the first signs of dissolution, and instead of sprinting to distraction or grandiosity, you rebuild the vessel and lower the heat. You ask for help sooner. You interrupt old patterns earlier. You waste less time on the arguments that used to consume months. The spiral tightens in the best way, more depth per revolution, less collateral damage. Return is tested in the mundane. Can the insight survive a Tuesday of errands, deadlines, and disagreement? Can the tenderness you discovered for your own life extend to the stranger at the counter who is having a worse day than you? Can the clarity you won in silence persist when the room is noisy? If the answer is often enough yes, you have returned. Not to the person you were, not to the mask you wore, but to a life that can hold more reality without cracking. The crucible has done its work, and now the work is to live. Interludes, the artist, she had a style that sold. Quick light, generous pigment, just enough edge to let buyers feel brave without being threatened. Galleries liked her openings because people smiled near her canvases and wrote checks. Then the night came as silence in the studio. Her hand would not repeat the gesture it had practiced for a decade. Color turned to noise. Each brushstroke arrived like a lie. She stopped showing up for a while and told everyone she was experimenting, which was a politer way of saying she could not stand herself. Dreams began to arrive, a kiln with a hairline crack, a bowl that leaked, a small red square that kept its heat. She made small work she would not let anyone see, studies of shadow, the color of bruised fruit, the way a window cools a room at noon. She spoke to the part of her that wanted applause and asked it to take the bench. Slowly, surfaces stopped performing and started breathing. When she returned to a gallery a year later, some collectors were confused. A child stood a long time in front of a quiet canvas and said, not to her but to the air, "It feels honest." That was enough. The founder. His company had become his surname. People introduced him with the product in the same breath, and he pretended not to like it while making sure they kept doing it. The board wanted velocity. His body wanted sleep. Then the market turned. The raise failed, and the story he had been living spun out of his hands. For a month, he carried two phones like talismans and answered neither. Nights were long rooms full of numbers marching without faces. The descent didn't announce itself with poetry. It arrived as panic and a shame he could not metabolize. An analyst gave him a chair and a rule about telling the truth once a day. A dream brought him to a workshop where a blade was tempered, heat, water, heat again, and the smith refused all shortcuts. He began walking before dawn with nothing in his ears. He wrote, badly and without audience, until sentences stopped trying to raise another round. He told the board the real runway and didn't dress it up. He paid overdue vendors before paying himself. The company did not become a unicorn. It became a business that could breathe. So did he. The respect that returned was quieter and more useful than the admiration he lost. The caregiver. She had learned to make pain manageable for others and invisible in herself. On the ward, she moved with decisive kindness, a sequence of gestures so practiced they looked like grace. At home, she was caring for her mother, and the two lives braided until no hour belonged to her alone. Exhaustion turned the days metallic. She caught herself snapping at a patient's nephew for asking a question with fear in it, and the look on his face sent her to the supply closet to cry over a box of gloves. Sleep thinned. The night brought water, river after river, and the same image of a small ferry that could carry only what it could carry. She began to sit at her kitchen table before the shift and write one page she would never show anyone. She lit a candle when she washed the dishes after midnight. She told a supervisor she needed 2 months on hospice rotation, where truth is spoken without euphemism, and she learned to say, "I'm here," and let it be enough. Her mother's breath grew shallower, her own grew slower. When the end came, it was not tidy, but presence survived it. She returned to the ward with a smaller voice and a steadier hand, less interested in saving anyone, more faithful to staying. Reading Path for the Road begin with Jung in The Key of the Ordinary. Modern Man in Search of a Soul is a doorway rather than a doctrine, a set of essays that show his method at human scale, dreams approached with respect, neurosis recast as unlived life, analysis framed as a collaboration rather than a cure. If you want to see how images move a person from breakdown toward form, it remains a generous companion. When you are ready to let the images lead, open the red book. Do not read it as a manual. Sit with it the way you would sit with weather, slowly, receptively, a few pages at a time, letting its painted figures and dialogues teach you how the psyche speaks when the ego stops narrating. If the Crucible's grammar intrigues you, Psychology and Alchemy shows how the old metallurgies become a language for psychic change. It is dense, but it will make your dreams more articulate. For a bridge written with lay readers in mind, Man and His Symbols offers case material and imagery that return the theory to life. Alongside Jung, find company in Marion Woodman. She writes as someone who has given her body permission to tell the truth. Addiction to Perfection is not a book about substances. It is a book about the ways we numb ourselves with ideals, and about how the feminine, understood as a mode of being rather than a gender, returns to balance a life driven by achievement. Her journals and lectures reward slow reading. They bring the work down from abstraction into kitchens, sick rooms, and studios where transformation either learns to cook or remains pretend. If you are tempted to bypass feeling with metaphysics, Woodman will gently, insistently call you back to breath. James Hillman will not let you forget that psyche means soul, and that soul has a taste for depth over improvement. The Dream in the Underworld asks you to stop rescuing dreams from their darkness and to meet them where they live, on their terms, without turning them into inspirational slogans. The Soul's Code argues for the acorn within, a pattern of calling that asks you to become particular rather than merely successful. Hillman can be contrary. Let him be. He will sand down the utilitarian edges of your reading and return imagination to its central place in a life that wants to be fully lived. The phrase "dark night of the soul" comes from St. John of the Cross, and his poem with its commentaries remains both severe and tender. Read it not for ascetic heroics, but for the way it trusts a silence that does not flatter the ego. The night he describes is not punitive, it is purgation in the service of love, and much of its wisdom translates cleanly into psychological language once you allow metaphor to do its work. If you carry a spiritual tradition, St. John will help you hold its practices more lightly and its truth more closely. If you do not, he will still teach you something about consenting to a process you cannot control. For passages that feel more like flood than furnace, Stanislav and Christina Grof offer a framework that protects dignity while insisting on safety. Their writing on spiritual emergency gives language to experiences that can look pathological from the outside, yet carry a core of meaning from within. The value here is not permission to romanticize crisis, but guidance in building the supports, clinical, communal, practical, that let transformation proceed without tearing the vessel. Read them when intensity outruns your routines, and you need a map that includes hospital corridors as well as meditation rooms. None of these authors is an authority to be obeyed. Treat them as elders at the fire. Listen, test, return to your life and see what holds. Read slowly enough that your own images keep their voice. Keep a notebook nearby and let a line or a symbol follow you into the day. If a book makes you clever but less kind, set it down for a while. If it makes you quieter and more honest, keep it close. The point of a reading path in this territory is not mastery. It is companionship that steadies the hand while you do the work that only your life can do. Closing benediction. No ending here is final. There is only a turn toward the day with what you now know. The night will come again in smaller ways, and you will remember sooner how to meet it. You will rebuild the vessel without theatrics, set the kettle on, open the notebook, and let the heat speak until it cools. You will ask for help without shame. You will protect your life so that it can be transformed, and you will let transformation prove itself in kindness rather than in claims. Trust the smallest fidelities. Wash the cup. Keep the promise you made to yourself when no one was watching. Tell the truth before the story grows elaborate. Let beauty interrupt you. Let sleep be an ally. If a practice makes you harder or louder, loosen your grip. If it makes you plainer and more present, keep it near. Choose steadiness over spectacle. Choose relationship over performance. Choose reality over pose. May the night, when it comes, be a passage and not a prison. May your vessel hold and your fire tell the truth. May the figures that visit you come as teachers rather than tyrants, and may you answer them with a courage that does not need an audience. What is false can burn, what is true will remain. Walk gently, keep the flame. Return when you forget, and begin again.